everybody. Welcome back to Bravo Unscripted. I am so excited that you're here with me today. This is going to be a good one. My very special guest today is Dr. Shahana Alibi, and she is a professional speaker. She's a family physician. She's a mental health expert, an author, and just all around amazing human. And we connected through Brand Builders, which is an organization that we both belong to and are very fond of. And we connected over our similar views on improving your emotional intelligence. And we talk about, you know, the epidemic, anxiety, and all of those things. And I love one of the things that she's going to share is that she feels like the epidemic is more about numbness and how we avoid and we check out. And it was just so profound to me. We had such an amazing conversation. So she is a huge advocate for emotional literacy, for better mental health, which is the title of her TEDx talk that I would strongly recommend you check it out. And I will have the link to that dropped in the show notes. She is a master at blending her personal story of postpartum anxiety and the resulting shame and denial and mental health challenges that she had with her professional background and cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness meditation. This is a phenomenal conversation. I'm super excited to bring it to you. Enjoy every minute, grab yourself a cup of tea and get comfortable because I really think you're going to love this one. So without further ado, we'll begin the interview and I'll be talking to you guys in a few.
Dr. Shahana, welcome to the show. I am so excited to have you here today. Really grateful to Brand Builders for bringing us together and making the introduction. And there's so many things that I want to talk to you about today. So I have tons of questions, and I think this is going to be just an amazing conversation. We chatted a little bit before we jumped on camera about sort of the commonalities in our thoughts around mental health with your physical health and self-acceptance and self-worth and self-love and how all of these things come together. So I'm really excited to get going. So I'm going to turn this over to you to just tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great when our paths crossed like this, and also that we have so much in alignment just in the terms of the way that we think. And I sometimes think people need to hear it in different ways. I think whatever we are talking about might have already been said before, but the way that we're saying it, somehow that will capture people's attention. And hopefully that will be the case after listening to this podcast as well too. So for me, you know, it's really easy to describe myself as a physician, a speaker, a mom of three young boys. But the much more interesting story, the story that I think I learned the most from, was when I became the patient. So after the birth of my first son about 9 years ago, I went from believing that mental health was a you disease, it was a you problem, you were the one that needed helping, to me being the fixer, the hero in the story. And I think what happened was that I had built up this fortress almost, that I thought I had too much education and therefore almost too much prestige and power for mental health or emotional health ever to penetrate that wall. And it all came crashing down in a big way, like many of these events do happen. And it was just that ultimate wake-up call of all of those paper cuts of trying to numb and escape and suppress and blame other people for your emotions. Everything finally came to the surface. And it was this reconciliation of dealing with postpartum anxiety and OCD and depression and suicidality and all of it. Life never gives you just an appetizer of what you want. It gave me the main dish and more, right? And it felt like it gave me too much that I could handle at once. So it forced me, if you're not going to take the time, life will eventually give you the time to say, you need to take a step back. And that's exactly what happened too. So all of that to say that finally I started to speak a version of my truth and on the TEDx stage, the first talk I ever gave in 2019, where I called myself a hypocrite, because I absolutely was. I really felt that I was, I'll just be blunt, I thought I was too good for mental health. And the goal now is that I see mental health as meant for all. That's what mental health stands for, because I would never look at my kids and say that they would judge me for seeing a personal trainer. So then why is their judgment for seeing a counselor? And this is the conversations we need to start as early as their young age, which is 4, 6, and 8.
Yeah, I love that, because I think there's such a stigma around mental health, although I do see it starting to shift. I feel like the conversation is much more mainstream. And I love that because, you know, I think one of the things people struggle with a lot when it comes to mental health is the shame aspect of it. And, you know, shame thrives in the dark. So if you don't have a safe space to talk about it, or it's not acceptable, I mean, nobody would ever look at you and go, ooh, like you have cancer and you're getting chemo. Like, what's wrong with you? But, you know, there's this stigma around mental health that we should just be able to butch up and deal with it. I love that this conversation in general with people is it's becoming more mainstream and it is becoming more accepted. And, you know, I think we still have a long way to go. I know you're in Canada and your healthcare system is very different from ours, but I was in healthcare for a long time. That was what I did before becoming a coach. But the way we treat mental health and the way we treat mental health coverage is criminal. Because like we said earlier, and I want to talk a little bit more about this, if you don't feel good internally, if you're mentally struggling, it's going to show up. It's going to show up everywhere.
Well, we have to stop breaking apart the body in pieces and start breaking apart our mental and physical health. Like we've done this, it's a story as old as time that, okay, you know, I'm only going to deal with this and I'm only going to deal with this. Yes, the body is extremely complex, but what's more complex than anything is our mental health too. And the idea that its tentacles reach every single part of our body. You can't just think that, you know, the reason I'm not coping, for example, and the reason I might be also tired and having headaches and having low back pain and abdominal pain, you know, it would be ignorant to think that those two things can't be related. And although like we are very blessed in Canada, yes, to have parts of our medical system, one of the biggest constraints is that most family doctors have a very short amount of time. So in 7 or 10 minutes, when you're seeing a patient, how much of that conversation are you having that is very pertinent to going, why are you here? And why are you here now? And what happened to you in your life? Like to answer those three questions is extremely difficult in such a compressed time frame. But yet if we don't, we're missing the mark.
Yeah, and so much, you know, I guess it's a relatively new field for most people on like the gut microbiome and your gut health and how that affects your mental state and how your mental state affects that. And your gut and your brain are constantly talking to each other and essentially stressing each other out, like depending on what you're going through, because we all know like, you feel anxiety or you feel something come up, where's the first place you feel it? Generally, like in your gut, like your gut tightens up, you feel anxious, the hair on the back of your neck, like it's a physical response. We're wired for that physical response. But I think so much of us these days, our bodies beautifully can go into that fight or flight mode, dispel the threat and come back to center. But I think most of us tend to live in that fight or flight.
Well, correct. And I think what you said is important there too, because I think it's even a win to recognize that you're living in fight or flight. But I think most of us, I always use this example that we don't suffer from anxiety or depression as an epidemic. We suffer with the inability to feel anything at all. What the epidemic I see is numbness, is cognitive blunting. It's just not willing to feel. So in fact, fight or flight would be progress from that. I think we've actually either surpassed that or hit it short, and now we just feel nothing. And you can see that when you go to the airport or go to the mall or even waiting at school pickup. A lot of the times you ask people how they're doing, I'm just fine. It's just a reflexive fine. But actually, how are you doing? And it takes people sometimes so long to figure that out because we've become very dissociated from our body awareness or our body quotient.
Yeah, that for me, through my own personal healing journey, that somatics and coming back to my body and tapping in that awareness was the big game changer for me, because intellectually, I could talk to you all day about what I was going through and why it was there and what it meant. But I wasn't feeling it. I was completely, it's like I was somebody stepping outside of my body and just going, oh, okay, so this is what's going on with you. And it wasn't until I really started getting into somatics and coming back into my body and feeling things that it became a game changer. So I think you're 100% right. And we had a conversation this morning with a friend of mine, and we were talking about how it's like numbing is the thing to do. It's like a badge of honor to numb coming home and having a glass or two or a bottle of wine is like a coping mechanism. And it's one that people are like, yeah, this is like what I do. I come home. And like, when did we start avoiding and running away from everything between drinking or our phones or binging Netflix for hours at a time? What are your thoughts around that? And how do you feel about this whole epidemic of numbing?
Well, what's so interesting is most people expect me as a physician to talk more about the what we call the DSM-5 criteria of psychiatric diagnosis, whether it be, you know, bipolar, ADHD, anxiety, depression. But I call them the three amigos of mental health, the ones that kind of lurk underneath the surface. One is numbing, which we just talked about. The other is boredom. And I don't see this as much as in adults as I do in adolescents, but this severe kind of almost bone numbing boredom that people have. And it's once again, I think it's just another version of numbing. I once had the 17-year-old who ended up in ICU from drinking so much. And she came to see me when obviously she was out. And I had to ask her, I said, let's break down the drinking. I said, when are you drinking? Are you drinking alone? Are you drinking socially? Tell me more. And she looked at me like I was the stupidest person on earth. And she's like, what do you mean? She's like, I'm just bored. I'm just bored. That's why I drink so much. As if that was the most obvious answer. And that really shock me hard because I thought, I've never ever heard that. But then as I started to listen, I got it from more and more and more adolescents. And I think what we're going to see in this next generation is this idea of severe boredom because we don't know how to deal with our emotions. So we just feel flat, right? And that's hitting the nail on the head is we don't know how to deal with our emotions because we're scared of our emotions. You know, nowadays, if you're lucky, you teach your kids that emotions are like a wave. They come and they go. They crest and eventually they fall. But you have to let it crest. You have to actually feel what you're feeling. We're too busy living in a society where we keep wanting to hero each other. And by hero each other, that's part of that drama triangle. You're either the victim, the villain, or the heroer. And the heroer just wants to make everything better. But the caveat is providing temporary relief. I constantly want to hero my kids. Just the other day, we were at Stampede, a huge carnival in Calgary, Alberta. And my middle son won this, I can't even begin to tell you, ginormous tie-dye, ugliest teddy bear in the world, but about three times my size from one of those carnival games. My eldest son, who is quite competitive and really values fairness, just couldn't get over this thought that his younger brother had won something ginormous and he had come out empty-handed. All I wanted to do was just to give him cash so he could continue to play the game to win. My husband looked at me and said, don't hero him. He needs to realize life isn't fair. He got his shot, didn't happen. He had to sit with all of that emotion. And what bubbled up to the surface was envy. He wanted something that he couldn't have. Does that make him a bad person? Absolutely not. But I grew up feeling like any uncomfortable emotion made me a bad person. But how can it? When it comes and goes, right?
There's so much gold in what you just said, so much gold. And feeling our emotions and allowing them, because we start to feel uncomfortable and immediately it's, okay, what can I do to stop this? Especially when it comes to being angry. You know, we're sold this thing that being angry is just, don't feel anger. No, that's bad. That makes you a bad person. And what happens with anger, and it sounds like you saw this with your son, is he was angry at his brother, but what was really underneath that was envy. But because you allowed him to sit with that, he got underneath that anger and he saw the envy and he was able to look at it and kind of make a decision. Okay, so yes, it's normal that I felt this. Cool. Like, I saw it. I felt it. I'm there. I'm going to sit with it and going to move on instead of carrying this anger, carrying this resentment, and then having shame thrown on top of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think we have to be so careful because I'll be the first one to call myself out on that. I wanted to be the savior. Like, I think there's two people, like there's usually two people who dance with an emotion, the person who's having the emotion and the person, the spouse, the partner, the mother, the father, the uncle, the aunt, who just wants to save the day. Like just say, look, I just took it away. And sometimes what you're doing is robbing them of that experience. Like I get asked this all the time, are millennials or Gen X's less resilient? And I say, well, no, not exactly. But I think they have been robbed of some of those opportunities where fail needs to stand for finally an important life lesson. Finally an important life lesson. That's what fail, because I lived on a tightrope most of my life. Like I never was allowed to or did make any mistakes. My mom said, you never had a tantrum. You never did this. You never did that. So I always thought that check, 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 perfection. Until I made the world's biggest lesson and I went to the wrong, you know, I chose the wrong career. I spent $60,000. I moved across the country. I did it all in a very short amount of time. So life will come and find you eventually, right? And if you can just start to re-perception yourself that actually this is where my emotional compass is pointing. This is what I value. That's the whole purpose of an emotion in the first place. It teaches you and points you towards what you value. If that happened to my youngest son, he'd be like, whatever, I got a small stuffy and a lollipop, I'm good. I don't care about this big stuffed toy. All he wants is candy. My eldest son values fairness. And that's been the sense since he was really little. So I reminded him, I said, it's a really good thing, but life's not always fair. So use those experiences as a compass. And actually imagine that compass. Where is it pointing me? What do I value here?
Yeah, and teaching them coping skills, like teaching them what to do when you're angry. Because let's face it, like you said, life's not fair. People are going to make you angry. Things are going to happen. People are going to cross your boundaries a lot. That's life. And if you don't know how to deal with it, then you're going to live your life just in this constant state of reaction.
Absolutely.
And when you allow your kids to fail, you're doing them a favor. Because first of all, when we fail, that's kind of when we sit and think about things. You know, you don't think about things a whole lot when you're kind of winning and you're just going through the things are going and, you know, you're just along for the ride. But when you fail or when something doesn't go the way that you want it to, that's when you kind of, if you have the emotional intelligence and you have the self-awareness, you can sit back and be like, okay, so wait a minute, like what happened there? And you can learn from that. So you don't continue to repeat that cycle. But when we do, especially with kids, and I see so many kids, I think there's such a high level of expectation put on kids these days. At the same time, like there's this high level of expectation, but nobody teaches them how to maneuver that. Nobody teaches them how to decide what they want. And I love this. And I heard it in one of the interviews you did. You talked about like you started medical school and then you wanted to be a chiropractor. So you shifted and then you were like, nope, not the road for me. And I think your words were with your tail tucked between your legs, went back to medical school. But I love that you had the awareness because too, I think a lot of us, we dig in and we're like, I spent $60,000. Like I'm here. I've got to do this. I've got to follow this. And I have to see this through. And that's not always the case. And that's where I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that piece of self-awareness.
You know, I think there is this yin and yang teeter-totter that happens between this idea of self-worth, even what we talked about, the example with my son, which was a, you know, small but benign type of example, this idea of self-worth. And what I talk about is, are you rubber or are you glass? When something doesn't go your way, when you fail, when the outcome doesn't happen to which you want it to happen, do you shatter like that glass, like champagne glass falling onto the table? Or are you like those annoying rubber balls that my kids carry all the time that are bouncing constantly up and down the house, right? So which one are you going to be? But this notion of self-worth is built between two things. One is it's all about biography. It's less about, there's a bit of biology, but a lot more about biography. It's about who did you perceive as experts in your life growing up? What, your parents, your siblings, your coaches, your teachers? And what happened to you? What were the experiences that led you to believe that you could be resilient, have grit, push through, or just succumb to victim mode? So I think this self-worth is so important because we can't have the conversation about self-awareness until we know where somebody is with regards to, am I rubber or am I glass, right? Because the minute you start to open that closet, most of us are familiar with Friends and Monica's closet and that idea of stuffing everything and for 40 years, and now I have to take a look at it. People are going to close the closet and go the other way. It's too hard, right? Mm-hmm. So self-awareness is so much more than that. We have to bolster it on. What do you think of yourself? And can you acknowledge yourself for where you are at right now?
Yeah. Acceptance, I think, is a big challenge for people because there's a belief that acceptance is an acknowledgement, but it's kind of like it can be perceived as complacency, which I don't feel that it is. I mean, I believe self-acceptance is the key to getting anywhere, because it's just like if you're going on vacation and you're driving and you get in the car and you put the address into your GPS, that's only half of what the GPS needs to get you to where you need to go. The other half is it has to know where you are now, and life is that way. And if we don't acknowledge all of the beautiful parts of us, the parts that we deem the shiny parts, the part that we deem the shadow, and you know, our successes, our failures, those moments that we look back and we're like, oh my God, what was I thinking? All of that, all of those pieces come together to make the beautiful human that you are now. And I speak a lot on embracing the whole of who we are. We cannot love ourselves in bits and pieces. You have to love all of you, even the parts that did things that you're not proud of.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is reconciling with this voice. I'll never forget this time a woman came up to me after the presentation and she's like, my father would always tell me, you think so much of yourself, don't you? You're never going to amount to anything. You know, I think so much of that self-worth is learning to quiet the voices of other people that we now take on as our own voice, right? If you've had that message given to you since a young age where you're told that you're not worthy of it, shame to me is fear plus unworthiness. It's fear of being alone, for example, and the feeling that I'm not worthy of connection. So how do you start to shift that dialogue and take that voice that maybe belonged to somebody else and now you've adopted onto yourself too? So you're so right. I love that idea of looking in and leaning into all the different pieces of you, because you wouldn't be who you are unless you actually had all those pieces come together, right? In this imperfect, perfect vase. That's what I like to think of it as too. The other piece is that self-acknowledgement is often written as a prescription for leniency, when in fact, it's the foundation for self-awareness, right? That is your jumping off point. So we need to stop thinking of it as that prescription for sit back, relax, do nothing. The question becomes, can we turn our focus to serving others? Because we can do all of this inner work, but sometimes we get caught up. It becomes too complicated for our own brains when it's about us. The minute you shift, just like for you, to serving others, to helping others with the denominator of I am enough, that to me is the formula for life. Service on top, the denominator being I am complete, I am enough. Because that's the yin and yang of it. That's the I'm going to go help somebody else. I'm going to keep pushing and keep progressing, but I don't need to change necessarily the flaws, the perfections, all of it that I've stood for.
Yeah, it's amazing when we start to look at ourselves and our stories and the things that we believe about ourselves, and we can identify where they came from. And so many of it is childhood. I mean, it can be your parents, your grandparents, it can be your peers, your siblings. When I started unpacking, I had a thing that happened when I was in the fourth grade that I had just changed schools. And they had put me in the gifted and talented program. And part of my identity was that I was smart. And I misunderstood the instructions that the teacher gave on something. So I didn't do it right. And the teacher was like, well, clearly they made a mistake and they put me back in mainstream. And nobody would listen to me that I just misunderstood what they were asking me for. And that story stuck with me and, you know, drove a lot of my internal, people aren't going to listen to me. What I have to say is invalid. It's not important. And when I started unpacking that, I was like, this was some teacher in fourth grade and I am still giving that value.
Wow. Exactly. But it just shows you, right? It just shows you, like, it does. It does. You can be so young and it really does fester and affect you, right? It affects the narrative because it becomes part of your own narrative. It's no longer the teacher's narrative. You are the one who actually believes that. So that's like that unhinging of, actually, it was never me in the first place, right? But that all takes that work. And I think that's what makes self-awareness has become such a sexy term lately, and it's good that it is, but I think it's hard to do properly once if you don't have this foundation or at least given this some thought.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, it is also like that ability to look at ourselves with curiosity and without judgment. Because so many times we want to look at ourselves and be like, dumb, dumb. But it's like, no, just with curiosity, where did that come from? How did that come up? How did that make me feel? Do I want to carry that forward? Why am I still holding on to it? All of those things. And yeah, being able to look at yourself without judging yourself.
Yeah. And that's the premise of the book that is coming out in September. Is one of the key points came to me from multiple actually male adolescents that I worked with. And finally, sometimes I would come to a point in our conversations going, what are we doing? Like, you miss your appointments, you're not compliant with your medications. Like, I would just be straight up with them, which is usually the best way to be with adolescents. And I had several on independent occasions tell me, when I posed the questions, do you even like yourself? And I took a risk by saying that. I didn't know what they were going to come at me with. And I was doing it as a bit of a test. Every single one of them used the same answer. They said, I, and then expletive, 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 hate myself. Hmm. And it was the same answer over and over again. And it's interesting. I think what I love about adolescents is that they're very, usually, they'll tell you as it is. They're quite blunt. They're straight up. But I got the same, much more watered down version when I would talk to 40-year-old women in my clinic. Right. So it's the same theme. One is just more in your face and one is more kind of receded. But I think this idea of everything that we've just talked about, the acknowledgement, the awareness, the acceptance of your emotion, not being who you are, but what you feel at that time, and then the action. That is the feel better method that's going to be in the book. Those are the four A's. And we've kind of chatted about that in different segments during this conversation.
Okay, so you went over that a little quickly, and I don't want to give up too much because I want people to go and buy your book. But can you go over those four A's again for us?
No, of course, of course. So the first one is self-acknowledgement, or you can just call it inner acknowledgement. Exactly what we were talking about right now. How does one think about their self-worth? How does one think about their experiences and those they perceived as experts? And there's exercises in the book where you can actually timeline yourself. You can think back to childhood. All of this can be done on your own with a workbook. Of course, the best work is with a guided therapist or healthcare practitioner, but it gets the ball rolling. That's what I want for people. The second is the awareness. And when you're thinking about awareness, you're thinking about the three clues that emotions are leaving you. We talked about that a little bit, the sensation, the thing that you felt that you would become a bit dissociated from. A lot of us have. From our body, because we're too scared to not just think we have the emotion, but to feel the emotion in the first place. Then it's the story that we're telling ourselves and selling ourselves in our head. And the story is influenced by those experts or people we perceived as experts, right? Like the teacher or a parent or a coach. And then it's the significance. Just like my son with the teddy bear, he valued fairness. He wanted things to be even. So for him, his emotional compass was telling him that I have such a visceral reaction to this because I need things to be black and white, right? So that the three S's piece of self-awareness, the sensation, the story, and the significance all comes into play. The last two A's are the acceptance. You have to allow, you can't change your emotion. You can just soften it. Just like you keep butter out on the counter. It's the same way. We've all done that. Cut through really hard butter. You don't go too far. Or when the butter is out on the counter, it just glides right through. That's softening your emotion. And the last step is action. What are some tangible things that you can do? And most of them involve physical, because when you're in that heightened emotion, you don't take out a piece of paper and like, that's hard to do. So you channel that mental energy through a physical outlet. And I talk about that in the book.
I love that. I love what you're saying about acknowledging and owning, because I think escapism has just taken root and it is at the detriment of everybody, because avoidance doesn't do anything for anyone. And it's funny because I laughed when you said it, because I remember the episode of Friends and Monica in the closet, because yeah. And listen, we've all done that. I did that for years and years and years. Just tuck things away. No, I'm fine. I don't need to deal with that. No, I'm just like, I'm over it. You know, it's like, no, you're not. You're not over it until you process it. And there's a beautiful art to all of this and not getting lost in it. But we've just become so afraid to face what we feel and move through it. And I'm not sure where that's coming from, but you know, I love this concept of feeling those emotions, but you can't let them rule. Just because you're angry doesn't mean you get to say, okay, I'm angry, so I'm going to go beat the heck out of this person or whatever. Like, you have to be responsible and process it and find a healthy outlet.
Completely. And I think part of the reason I think we're seeing all of this, it's not lost on me that a lot of this goes along with productivity, hustle culture, you know, like mom boss, like everything is more, because all of this, even for our adolescents, we only value the outcome. Don't show me the process. Don't show me how you got there. Show me the degree. Show me the product. Show me the money. Show me the fame. Show me the sports skill. Show me anything, right? So that a lot of this is because of this outcome-driven society, right? And it's so easy to fall prey to that. And I do constantly, because that's what is rewarded. We look at the report card. We don't ask our kid, you know, how are you actually doing in class when you were struggling during math? Or how are you actually figuring it out when your teacher's asking you this and you don't know the answer to it? How are you versus what are you, right? Very different question.
Yeah, I love that, because, and let's face it, most of us are high achievers. So we set a goal, but before we even get close to that goal, we're already looking three rungs up the ladder. So we're not even celebrating the goal. We're not even celebrating the achievement anymore. It's just moving from, just like you said, this constant hustle and have to go. And God forbid you stop and celebrate something that you've done. People are like, what is wrong with you? I was on a hike the other day with my stepdaughter and her husband, and we were talking about this because the hike was tough. So we were laughing, you know, because she's a therapist, he's in recovery. We're all very self-aware. I was just laughing. I was like, yeah, like, you know, you just want to get there. But like, we were stopping along the way and like the views, and it was just, you know, like this kind of metaphor for life. Like, the journey is where it's beautiful. Yeah, it was beautiful when we got there. The waterfall was magical. It was, you know, but there was so much along the way. And that's where the real beauty is, because that's the experience. You get to the top and you're like, okay, I'm hungry and I want to get something to eat. So, you know, the journey was where most of the conversation, all of that happened. And, you know, it was just really beautiful to kind of acknowledge that. I'm so excited for your book. The release date again is September 20th.
And with end of September, last week of September.
End of September. Yeah. Perfect. And I will put in the show notes where they can go to get that when it comes out. Are they able to pre-order?
They can pre-order, and there's lots of bonuses that we're offering too. So it's just on my website, drshahana.com. We can include it in the show notes, and pre-sales are available, which is great.
Awesome. Is there, before we wrap, because we're coming up on time, is there anything else that you want to share? Well, again, we'll put in the show notes about the book and where to find you and all of that good stuff.
Exactly. Come say hi to me on LinkedIn. I'm very active there, on Instagram as well. But honestly, if you're listening to this podcast and you take one thing away for us, I'm sure, if I can speak for you too, that's a job well done. Because sometimes even when you read all these books on the shelf, you just come up with that one thing, that one analogy, that one metaphor, that one story that you can take away. So hopefully you've found something that you can carry in your heart.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. Yeah. And just a reminder that, you know, whatever your journey, however you got here, however you found this podcast, whatever you're going through, like you're beautiful and perfect and exactly where you need to be right now. And that acceptance of that little piece is going to be the key to you getting to wherever it is that you want to go in your life. So Dr. Shahana, thank you so, so much. This was just such a beautiful conversation. And I'm so grateful to you for coming on the show and spending time with me today. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was great.